Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You've heard of the U.S. GDP, the gross domestic product that's supposed to measure the economic well-being of Americans. Now there's an alternative, an index of health, education, and income based on official government data. We've invited the co-directors of the American Human Development Project to the show today. They're also the authors of The Measure of America, American Human Development Report. Sarah Bird Sharps worked with the United Nations for more than two decades, most recently for the United Nations Development Program. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Kristen Lewis, she worked for the United Nations Development Program and is co-author of the 2005 book, Health, Dignity, and Development, What Will It Take? Welcome to the show, Kristen.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
I guess just right off the bat, why do we need an alternative to the GDP? It's so easy to say GDP.
Yeah, it's true, it's easy to say, but economic indicators like the GDP tell an important story. How's the economy doing? The Measure of America and the work that we're doing, we want to tell the story of how ordinary people are doing. And we would say that we tend to rely on things, money metrics like GDP and inflation, et cetera, but actually, you know, the things that we're measuring, how long people are living, how much education they have, how much they're earning, really help to get a better sense of how ordinary people are doing.
Can you give me an example of how that works?
Sure. So basically just to say that this index is something that's been used around the world for about 20 years. It's not very well known in this country. What we do is we take, as you said, official government measures. So we use life expectancy at birth from the CDC, and we use education data, how the highest degree you've attained, and your earnings, your typical wages and salaries, and those both come from the Census Bureau. And we put them all together and divide by three, and you get one number. And that enables us, for instance, to rank every state in the nation. And on our ranking, it goes from Connecticut is the top to West Virginia is the bottom. But we can also rank every congressional district, every racial and ethnic group, and even men and women.
What is the value of rating or ranking, I should say, the congressional districts?
This is Kristen. It has a different value. One main thing is that it is attached to an elected official. So around the world, the Human Development Index has been used to hold elected officials accountable for the things that matter to people. And in our case, we would say that health, education, and income, the basic building blocks of a good life, are those things for Americans. And so if you have an elected official sitting there and you're able to say, why is our score this when just 10 miles away in another district, people are living 1 or 2 years longer, are earning $10,000 more, it's a way to sort of open a door to start a conversation about different outcomes for groups of people.
My guests are Sarah Bird Sharps and Kristen Lewis, co-authors of The Measure of America, 2010-2011, Mapping Risks and Resilience. It's part of the American Human Development Report. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you want to join this conversation. We're going to get to how Ohio ranks in a little while. If you have questions about that, how do you think Ohio rates? What are your thoughts about that? Give us a call or email us and let us know what you think. The last version of the measure was entitled The Measure of America, American Human Development Report. The latest is entitled The Measure of America, Mapping Risks and Resilience. Am I wrong about that? Have I confused things, or what would be the difference?
No, you've got it absolutely right. So in the first one, we sort of laid down a baseline. It was the first time we had done this ranking. The one that we just launched recently was really moving a little further and looking, you know, even deeper at why certain groups are surging ahead, enjoying some of the highest well-being in the world, and why other groups have fallen badly behind. And this idea of mapping risks and resilience is really looking at which groups bounce back from sort of catastrophic events. And what we found was that, take something like Hurricane Katrina, those groups who went into Katrina with, you know, weak health, very low levels of skills and education, no savings in the bank, et cetera, have taken a tremendously long time to bounce back from that. So they don't have much resilience to the risks that they faced, that risk of a hurricane or you know, man-made event or even the recent recession we've been through. Whereas groups in New Orleans and who were affected by Katrina, who went into it, you know, stronger with much more resilience with money in the bank, et cetera, good health, a solid education, strong support network, have bounced back much faster 5 years on, are actually doing okay, although they, of course, also suffered.
Were there any surprises or any big contrasts from the two different reports?
In terms of what's changed over the last 3 years?
Yeah.
Well, we saw just gradual improvement in terms of life expectancy. So people are living about 8 months longer. So life expectancy has improved, which is great. And school enrollment has also increased, and the educational attainment indicators have also inched up. I mean, what we saw is not going to really surprise anyone is that the median earnings actually sort of started to creep backwards a bit. So even though GDP has gone up in the last, say, 35 years, the GDP has actually tripled. Median personal earnings, so the average wages that a person makes from their work, have barely budged since the mid-1970s, and in the last, since 2000, those earnings have actually inched back, and you can really see that from 2005 to 2008.
That is, unless you're in the top echelon of earners in the country.
Right. For them, everything is fine. You know,
Everything's
earnings,
better. Twice is fine.
Twice is fine. So, their earnings have gone up, and that very small sliver of Americans has actually captured the lion's share of GDP growth and increased earnings and so forth, whereas the ordinary person, the median earner, hasn't seen any increase and has actually seen some backsliding in the last decade.
In the foreword to the book, Jeffrey Sachs refers to the cheek-to-jowl inequality in America. Can you talk about what he means by that? And does paying attention to congressional districts give us a little bit closer look at that?
Yes, absolutely. And so by cheek to jowl, you know, he's looking at some of the comparisons that we did to congressional districts that are nearly side by side. So, for instance, if you look in New York State, we have Manhattan, where it's the top district in the whole country, and the average typical wages and salaries of the typical worker are about $60,000. And then just 2 miles to the east in the South Bronx, there's a congressional district that's near the bottom and at the very bottom in terms of earnings. So the average wages and salaries of a worker there are about $18,000. So that's within 2 miles apart, $60,000 to $18,000 for the typical worker.
When I was looking at some numbers comparing African-American wages in Mississippi, the average annual earnings, versus Maryland, it was much higher in Maryland. But the cost of living is much higher there, too. Is there any way to adjust for that?
This is a fascinating question, and we get it a lot because it makes a lot of intuitive sense. People think, oh, well, you know, the cost of living in New York or around Washington, D.C., around L.A. is much higher. So shouldn't we change the index in a sense or account for that in some way? And although it makes intuitive sense, it's problematic to put into practice for a bunch of reasons. The main reason is there's no official measure to do that. There's no official methodology for comparing cost of living from place to place. So you can compare cost of living from 10 years ago to now in the same place, but you can't compare cost of living in New York to cost of living in Cleveland, for instance. And there are some unofficial measures to do that, but they only sort of take into consideration the consumption patterns of the richest people, of the people in the top 20% or so of the income distribution. They don't really account for rural areas at all. They focus basically on urban areas. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons that it's difficult, mainly because of this there's no official measure. But then also, even the measures that exist, and even if there were official measures, don't take into consideration things like the cost of living within a city varies. So we, for instance, compared rent and a basic basket of groceries, rice, milk, diapers, in two different parts of Manhattan, which is the place you think of as having the highest cost of living. Mm-hmm. And the rent for a two-bedroom apartment was three times higher in one neighborhood, over $6,000 than a month, than it was in another neighborhood. And the basket of groceries was 50 or so percent more in the more expensive neighborhood. So, again, that really is a it creates all sorts of problems. And you just look at the congressional district difference that Sarah just mentioned. Those mm-hmm. That's within the same city. That's within New York City. And they have the highest earners in the country there, and you have the lowest earners in the country there. So it's difficult. And then one last thing I would say is that the cost of living is mostly related to housing prices. That's the chief driver of these big differences in cost of living. And that encompasses a lot of things. So when you're buying your house or you're renting your apartment, it's not just the physical space you're getting, but you're getting public services, for instance. So you mm-hmm. might be getting public schools of very high quality. So two identical houses in two different school districts are going to have a really big difference in price if one is a great school district and one is a struggling school district. Or, you know, living near the beach is a lot more expensive than not. So you're paying, there are a lot of intangibles caught up in housing prices, and how to tease those out and reflect them is really difficult. So, again, we would love to do it, but for a lot of reasons, we can't really do it.
And I guess I could ask you right now, but it seems like this, the Measure of America, is a starting point to ask a lot of these questions for people, depending on what you're interested in, or what are the uses for it?
Exactly. I mean, this index itself only gets at, you know, for instance, how long you're living. It doesn't look at, you know, the quality of your life while you're alive. So the index is really exactly as you say. It's like the beginning of the conversation. And then you start to understand, you know, these huge differences, and then you look deeper at why. What are the factors behind it? And you look at other statistics as well. And our hope is that this will become essentially an official statistic alongside GDP to look at, you know, how people are doing. And that's sort of one big use of it. Another use is we want to sort of tap into American competitiveness and get people to want to be number one on this index alongside, you know, their number one in terms of whatever industrial strength or, you know, economic growth, et cetera. So we want people to clamor to be number one in terms of, you know, avoiding all of the, you know, reasons for early death, for having higher earnings for the ordinary person, et cetera. So that's another, you know, use for this index.
This sort of index is used around other places around the world. How does the United States rank?
Well, there's the United Nations does a ranking every year mm-hmm. of all the countries in the world, and they measure the same three areas as our index: mm-hmm. health, education, and income. But they use different set of indicators. So they use literacy, for instance. They use GDP per capita. Actually, now they've changed it to using. They are some earnings figure that they use. And traditionally, in the past, at the beginning, the U.S. was always right up there at the top. And then for many years, the U.S. really declined, and not because the U.S. was moving backwards on these important areas, health, education, and income, but rather because our peer nations, other affluent democracies, were moving much, much more quickly than we were in terms of ensuring their population has higher levels of education and better health.
We're going to take a quick break. My guests are Kristen Lewis and Sarah Bird Sharps. They're the author of The Measure of America 2010-2011, Mapping Risks and Resilience. Of course, I think you probably know where we're headed, Ohio, maybe even our congressional districts here in central Ohio. So stay tuned and join us if you want with your questions and comments, 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go onto Facebook as well. And when we return, we'll talk about how you can look at this online and look at the mapping as well. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
As the year winds down, a political junkie turns to reflection. On the best political moments of the year, the ads, the gaffes, the zingers, the cast of characters from Alvin Green to Christine O'Donnell.
I'm not a witch.
I'm Neil Conan. Send your nominee for best political moment to talk@npr.org and join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 13 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Partly sunny skies today, a high of 22 degrees. A chance of snow overnight, expect about an inch of accumulation, a low of 16. A chance of some morning snow on Thursday, an accumulation of around an inch or so. Cloudy skies for tomorrow, a high of 28 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guests are the co-directors of the American Human Development Project and the authors of The Measure of America, the American Human Development, 2010-2011, Mapping Risks and Resilience. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I guess for the benefit of the listeners out there, Sarah and Kristen, can we tell them where they can go to look at the mapping online and how they can use it?
Sure. Our mapping online is at measureofamerica.org/map. And it's a really cool new program that we've put up there where you can look at, you know, put your zip code in and see how your area stacks up compared with, you know, all of the, you know, nearby areas in Ohio in terms of all kinds of things, about 100 indicators you can look at. So you can look at how long people are living, what percentage are graduating from high school versus dropping out, you know, how they're doing on diabetes and obesity, and all, as I said, you know, 100 indicators in a whole range of areas, not just health, education, income, but also sort of housing and transportation, people voting, crime statistics as well.
Yeah, so some of the listeners out there, I'd love it if you'd poke your area or your zip code in there and give us a call and tell if there's anything that surprises you about where you live. One of the surprising things to me, I guess, is when you talked about the health and talked about who is living the longest. Asian Americans have the longest lifespan, 87.3 years, of any racial or ethnic group today, followed by Latinos. Latinos live on average 83.5 years, and I guess I was surprised at that given the income levels and the other indicators.
Yeah, it's a fascinating finding. You know, it's quite heartening in a sense that Latinos are living so long, because in the United States, among other racial and ethnic groups, and also actually all around the world you see this, higher levels of educational attainment are associated with longer lives. And Latinos in the United States are the racial or ethnic group with the lowest levels overall of educational attainment, yet they're living they're living significantly longer than whites, who overall have more higher levels of education and higher income. So in public health circles, this is known as the Latino paradox, that they sort of defy this trend of education and health being so closely linked. And there's a lot of research about why that's the case. And one finding that's emerging strongly is that social support, family cohesion, family closeness, all these kinds of things are quite possibly a contributing factor to longer lives for Latinos.
Does it correlate with anything else that you measure or any of the other measurements that you look at that would help explain that?
It does a few. So, for instance, Latinos have lower incidence of all sorts of risk behaviors. So they smoke less, they drink less than other Americans. So that's a very important thing, because the leading causes of death in the United States, what we're calling the true leading causes of death, are these fatal four risk behaviors. So smoking, poor diet, physical inactivity, and excessive drinking. So Latinos are smoking less, and they are also drinking less. And when they arrive, especially as immigrants, they have a much better diet. Now, the longer Latinos are here, the more they pick up the sort of poor health habits of other Americans.
Kind of ironic, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is.
I think it was in one of your press releases, it said that a baby born today in Virginia's Congressional District 8, the suburbs of D.C., can expect to live a decade longer than a baby born today in West Virginia's Congressional District 3, the southern rural part of the state. That's 83.7 years versus 72.9 years, which was interesting and not altogether surprising. I was wondering, is it about the same for Virginia's Congressional District 8 as it is for D.C.? Was there a way to look at that
Yeah, absolutely, because D.C. is, of course, a congressional district, mm-hmm. so we can put that into the mix as well. And we can see, you know, that there's absolutely huge, you know, those in the suburbs absolutely outlive those who are in the city proper by many, many years. Although what's really going on in Washington, D.C. is that it's actually the longest-lived place for whites and the shortest-lived place for African-Americans.
Because so much of the government is wrapped up and run by whites.
Well,
and so many of the people who live there are African-American.
I mean, that's a big part of it. I mean, what we would say is that, you know, we've spent the last 2 years in a fierce debate over health care reform, and it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's focused almost exclusively on medical treatments and medical care. And we would say that the conditions and circumstances of your daily life are what really drive your life expectancy. It has very little to do with doctors and with drugs. So what are those conditions? Well, if you have stress of constant job insecurity, that has an impact on your life. If you live in a clean environment, kids have nutritious school lunches, they can play outside in a safe neighborhood, those are the conditions and circumstances that matter for whether you have a long life or you have, you know, some of the factors that lead to an earlier death.
In his foreword, Jeffrey Sachs also notes the good news about the index that America remains highly productive and innovative. How is that measured?
That's not a measure in our index,
okay,
per se. I mean, it is something we looked at. So, for instance, you noted earlier in the conversation the differences between the earnings of African Americans in Mississippi and the earnings of African Americans in Maryland,
right.
And they're quite a significant difference. And there are lots of reasons for that. There's the rate of unionization. There's the availability of good jobs. But there's also things like that Maryland invests very heavily in the high-tech sector, in education, and in all of these things that create a more productive economy and a more knowledge-based economy. And that's what drives these higher earnings. So you can definitely see how the decisions that different states make in terms of their policy has a huge effect on people's earnings. So in a sense, it's indirectly reflected in the index.
My guests are Kristen Lewis and Sarah Bird Sharps. They're authors of The Measure of America 2010-2011, Mapping Risks and Resilience. You can join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Or you can go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if you like. Tell us how Ohio stacks up, though. You mentioned Connecticut at the top, Mississippi ranking last. Where does Ohio fall into that matrix?
Ohio is 31st.
It always is. You know, it's 31st or 33rd.
Yeah, 31st. So a little bit ahead of Indiana, a little bit behind Michigan. I mean, I think the good news is that Ohio is pretty average in terms of life expectancy, is ahead of average in terms of education, and earnings are about average or slightly below average. The other piece of good news is that there are some groups in Ohio that are soaring and that are doing better than the national average overall.
We are looking at Congressional District 15 right now, and it says it's represented by Patrick Tiberi. Oh, no, that's Congressional District 12. Right now, Congressional District 15 is represented by Mary Jo Kilroy. She was Steve Stivers will take over in that slot in January. There's a Human Development Index of 5.36. So what does that mean?
So our index, you're talking about Ohio's 12th district, right? So
yes.
The index goes from 0 to 10, and 10 is high. The average for the U.S. As a whole is 5.17. So Ohio's 12th district is ahead. So the way that score is arrived at, of course, is looking at health, education, and income statistics. So just to give you a couple of examples, so in that 12th district, 38.3% of adults have at least a bachelor's degree. That's significantly higher, you know, almost double what the national, not double, but it's significantly higher than the national average for bachelor's degree among mm-hmm. adults age 25 and older. And personal earnings there are about $34,600, which, again, is, you know, roughly $5,000 more than the national average.
Is When you look at these, what do you change? What did you change anything significant from in terms of the stuff that you look at and the kind of weight you give it between the two different reports?
In terms of the index itself, it's set. We don't want to change it because we want to look at change over time. But in terms of, you know, trying to drill down underneath these statistics and figure out, you know, why are people earning, you know, much higher in the 12th district and higher than they are, for instance, in the 6th district where they're earning, you know, more than $10,000 less. And then, you know, of course, we need each time to look at what's going on there. Things that change fast, things that change more slowly, et cetera. So that the research that we do once we have these numbers is really to figure out, you know, what's going on and what can we do? You know, what are the great policy examples or the great individual initiatives or even the great things that are happening in the private sector in one place that perhaps could be, you know, borrowed for another to achieve those same very, you know, very high earnings or, you know, long lives, et cetera.
Which groups in Ohio are doing best?
If you're looking at racial and ethnic groups, Asian Americans in Ohio, as in the country as a whole, have the highest levels of well-being overall, followed by whites, Latinos, and then African Americans have the lowest well-being scores in Ohio. So there's one big difference is life expectancy. So whites, Asian Americans are living over 83 years, whereas African Americans in Ohio are living only about 73 years. So it's a 10-year longevity gap between these two groups. Now, that's a bit smaller than the national average gap, but it's still 10 years. It's very significant. In terms of education, only about 1 in 10 adults in Ohio lack a high school diploma compared to 1 in 3 Latinos. So that's also a very big difference. But the proportion of Asian Americans in Ohio, for instance, which with a graduate or professional degree, is 3.5 times higher than that of whites in Ohio. So, you know, there are very big differences among the racial and ethnic groups in the state.
What about men and women?
Men and women. Let's take a look. Well,
nationally, women have higher overall levels of educational attainment, but their median earnings average about $11,000 less per year than men, which is typical.
Yeah.
No surprise.
And it's the same in every state. It's the same in Ohio, and it's the same, you know, all over the U.S. That women have higher scores now overall in terms of educational attainment and enrollment on our index, and yet they earn significantly less than men.
Are there any other correlation or any other measurements that talk about the quality of life of men versus women?
Well,
or is it strictly income?
No, we also look at the gap between men and women in terms of life expectancy. Now, what's interesting is that sort of biologically over the world, women tend to outlive men by about 5 years. But in certain groups and in certain places, that gap can shrink or stretch based on, you know, the kind of behavior, risk behaviors that those groups are taking or, you know, policies which are helping to narrow that gap. So it varies in the U.S. by race from, you know, I think about 5 years for Asian Americans to about over 7 year gap for African Americans, where African American women are outliving African American men by more than 7 years. And that has a lot to do with violence in that, you know, among African American males and other risk behaviors that are you know, creating a shorter life than the average biological gap.
And that's something we really explored in depth in this book this time, was what was driving the life expectancy differences between men and women. Because the easy thing to do is to say it exists all around the world, so it's biological, and leave it at that. But because there's such a range, and because in some countries the range is much bigger even than it is here, and the range Sarah's just been talking about, we really tried to look at the risks facing men in terms of health. And what we found is that, you know, men's behavioral norms, this idea of what it means to act like a man, really can be dangerous to men's health. So just to give a few examples, you know, physical risk-taking. So boys are encouraged or allowed to take many more physical risks than girls, so they have a higher accident and injury rate. They learn to be more stoic about pain or injury or things like that. So these kind of childhood lessons really bear fruit in the form of constrained care-seeking behaviors in adult men. reckless driving. You know, there's nothing biological about that. That has to do with, again, what it means to be a man or a boy. Men account for 3/4 of traffic fatalities. And when alcohol is a factor, 83% of the drivers in those crashes are men. And then, you know, care seeking, and then how people deal with stress. And, of course, this isn't all men naturally, but this is just how men, how sort of norms about what it means to be a man affect people's behavior. So women under stress are more likely to seek support, social support from friends. Men are more likely to engage in risk behaviors, drinking or detachment or all these other things. So, you know, it's overall that these behavioral norms really, really affect people's health.
We're going to take another break, but before we do, Sarah or Kristen, could you go over again how to enter in the zip code, how folks can participate in this themselves online?
Sure. If they just go to measureofamerica.org/map and just click that you want to enter in, and then you'll be on the map page, and it says find by zip code, and you can stick your zip code in there, and it'll bring you right to your congressional district. And on the right, there's a little thing that says at a glance, and if you click on that, you can see, you roll over it, you can see, you know, what your congressional district, what percent of the residents are of what race, you know, what percentage haven't graduated from high school, have a bachelor's, a graduate degree, et cetera. You can see who's your representative, et cetera, a bunch of information on that little at-a-glance sheet. And then the other thing is there's at the top it says charts, and you can compare. You can create a chart that shows, for instance, your district and any other districts in the country you're interested in, and then you can see, you know, sort of what rates they have of, you know, whatever, lead releases and, you know, how much people are spending on their rent and, you know, what percentage of people are voting. You can do all kinds of comparisons.
Okay, we'll take a quick break, and when we return, we'll get into some more about Ohio and maybe talk a little bit more about our knowledge, the index on knowledge in the United States. That may be something that changes pretty quickly, isn't it, Sarah, Kristen?
It can. Graduation rates of kids today can change quite quickly. You know, they can change in 4 years if a school is really able to turn around. Our indicator is the degree attainment of adults 25 and older. So we're looking at adults who've pretty much completed their education, and do they have a high school diploma or not. So that changes more slowly as the population, you know, ages and younger cohorts come into play. But we did introduce this time a sort of a dashboard of risks of things that change much more quickly, and one of those is on-time high school graduation. So we are looking at that. It's a critical indicator, and it does change and can change very fast.
All right. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Time is running out for you to make your 2010 tax-deductible contribution to public radio. Your support helps ensure that WOSU will continue to serve Central Ohio listeners in 2011. It's simple to make your pledge by December 31st. Give online at WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. Your contribution has never been more important for the future of public radio. Thank you for supporting WOSU this year.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, during Hour 2 of All Sides, we'll discuss Columbus City Council and local political news with Columbus Dispatch City Hall reporter Doug Caruso. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11. And be sure to listen to WOSU Public Media's new radio service, Classical 101. Start your day with Voice Lancaster every morning beginning at 6 a.m. It's classical music 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on Classical 101. 13 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today and a high of 22. A chance of snow overnight, less than an inch of snow, and a low of 16 degrees overnight. Some morning snow for Thursday, about an inch of accumulation and a high of 28 degrees. And looking ahead to Friday, some sunshine and a high of 28. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are Kristen Lewis and Sarah Bird Sharps. They're co-directors of the American Human Development Project, co-authors of The Measure of America 2010-2011, Mapping Risks and Resilience, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our website, wosu.org/allsides, and get the link to the data from The Measure of America. And go to Explore the Maps and plug in your zip code. Part of the book includes, of course, your conclusion, Agenda for Action, Reducing Risks, Building Resilience. Tell me how you went about putting that together.
Sure. What we were looking at really was how can we boost the scores on this index of all Americans, and how can we bring up the rear from those groups that are really falling behind. So what got into the Agenda for Action were those issues that are most critical for, you know, enabling these scores on this particular index to go up.
And what were your recommendations?
I'll give you a few. So In health, as Sarah mentioned earlier, we've really spent the last 2 years wrangling over healthcare reform, but in that time, the biggest health challenge that we face, which is the yawning life expectancy gaps that separate different groups of Americans, really didn't come up. You know, we didn't hear anything about that. So medical treatments are, of course, really important. You know, once you're sick, you need to have access to medical care. But to really bring up the scores of the groups at the bottom of the health index, improving the conditions of people's daily lives, so the conditions into which people are born, grow up, work, and grow old, that's what holds the greatest promise for longer, healthier lives for Americans. And so the social and economic disparities that breed ill health include, you know, low levels of income and education, discrimination and racial segregation, social exclusion, neighborhoods where people can't exercise or buy healthy foods, and chronic stress of insecurity. So in health, that was one major recommendation. Another was minimizing risks, especially exposure to these fatal four risks that I mentioned earlier of smoking, poor diet, physical inactivity, and excessive drinking. In education, we really emphasized universal preschool. So we really felt that leveling the playing field in terms of education really requires making universal preschool a national priority, because research shows that a high-quality early education is the single most cost-effective educational investment we can make. It pays dividends not just in terms of education and in terms of school readiness, but also it has this unbelievable lifelong effect. You know, studies have shown that people at-risk kids who got a really good early childhood education are more likely as adults to be homeowners, to be married. They're less likely to be in prison. They're less likely to need public assistance. They have higher earnings. So it really has a tremendously powerful effect, and it really needs to be a national priority. And I want to underscore that it has to be high-quality preschool. You know, just calling something preschool isn't enough. You need college-educated teachers, and you need low teacher-child ratios. And then in income, you know, as we mentioned before, our index measures earnings. But what's also really important, and another critical piece of the puzzle, is assets. You know, so what you own, your house, your savings, your stocks, and so forth. So in income, we really need to help middle-class and low-income families alike build these assets. You know, people need assets to weather turbulent times, to secure their old age, and to give their kids a leg up. And we also need to address something you alluded to earlier, which is the stubborn wage gap between women and men, with modern family-friendly policies that address the needs of working families. Right now, women really pay a high penalty for leaving the workforce to raise their kids, and it is primarily women still who are doing this caring labor of taking care of babies and small children and also sick relatives, elderly parents, and so forth. And in terms of wages and their career trajectory, they really do pay a penalty for that. So other countries have tackled this problem by having sick leave, by having vacation time, by allowing people to have paternity leave and maternity leave. So in some countries, even the family as a whole the woman can't take maternity leave unless the husband takes at least some paternity leave. Mm-hmm. So it's also addressing that and making it more possible for men to participate in their home lives, which is, you know, what a lot of men would like to do.
In the Agenda for Action, there's some hot-button issues when it comes to education, investing in the education of immigrant children. is noted, highlighted.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the research, you know, we see that kids who come from, you know, that the education of your parents is a huge driver of your educational outcome, and that, you know, when that, you know, looking at Latino kids, for instance, in this country, kids whose parents got citizenship versus kids who didn't, they were able to, you know, have higher educational outcomes and therefore to invest in themselves and their families and to, you know, reach beyond sort of the bare bones minimum in today's society of having a high school degree, going on to college, et cetera, makes a huge difference.
And one thing the census data is showing is that the proportion of immigrants is growing. And Latinos, for instance, are a growing share of Americans. And it's tremendously important that we invest in the education of Latino children because they're the fastest growing demographic group in the United States. And their educational levels, attainment levels, you know, are lower than those of other groups. So, you know, in terms of American competitiveness, in terms of just our the strength of our nation as a whole, our the workforce productivity, all these things, we really need to make sure that these kids have a fair shot, to not just for themselves, you know, to fulfill their own dreams and to live a life of choice and value, but also for all of us. It matters to the country as a whole.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Terry, you're on the air with Kristen Lewis and Sarah Bird Sharps. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Mm-hmm. I looked up my my stats. I'm from Youngstown, Ohio, and we don't look pretty good. You know, we're like 4.5. You know, and but Columbus has a higher index for it. You know, but it's kind of unfair because you know the median income is like 24,000, and it's more than that because what really irked me right now is our Congressman Tim Ryan gave us this. We applied and received the Appalachian status where it was supposed to get more money.
Right.
And that doesn't and it makes us look bad, like we're a bunch of hillbillies, you know, not educated, but we are with what we have a lot of educated people, but we learn our trade through our work. Mm-hmm. We don't go to college, you know, majority of us don't go to college. We learn our trade as we go to work and we might take classes to enhance our abilities. You know what I mean?
So Terry, are you kind of worried that this might be labeling?
Yes.
In a way that doesn't necessarily reflect. Sarah, Kristen, is this something that you grappled with?
Well, it is in a way, you know, because we certainly don't want to label anyone. And the thing we're trying to do is to put the information out there so that people there can be better policies and people can have the you know, because human development is very much about what you can do yourself, but it's also about the institutions of your society around you. So, you know, just that particular, is it Congressional District 17 that you're in?
Yes,
Terry?
Ma'am.
Yeah.
Tim Ryan.
Okay, so life expectancy at birth, for instance, there is 77, which is a year shorter than the national average, but about average for Ohio as a whole. The median, or it's basically that the median earnings are lower, and many fewer people have graduate degrees.
Right. And, oh, that is correct.
And, you know, and you know that makes sense if what you're saying. You know, if you look at metro areas, so the highest educational scores are going to be found like around Washington D.C. or Boston, L.A. areas where the labor market really rewards high levels of education.
Right.
And if that's not the case in your labor market, I guess. One thing I would underscore is this is not a moral judgment in any way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just talking about people's choices and opportunities. So, and it doesn't get at things like life satisfaction or happiness or any of those very important things. It doesn't measure those things. So, and it's not in any way a judgment. I mean, for instance, the issue we're just talking about, Latino educational attainment.
Right.
I mean, people have come, immigrants come with different levels of education, and they can make tremendous investments in themselves and their children by highlighting educational attainment as an issue of concern in the Latino population. We're not saying that as a judgment or as a criticism. We're saying, as for the country as a whole, you know, we need to make sure that this group has all the same choices and opportunities as other Americans. And that's what, you know, will make the country strong and great and so forth. So it's nothing, it's not meant to be a judgment. And I'm sorry if you're feeling that way, because that's not at all our intent.
Yeah, because, well, maybe because I'm so close to the issue. You know, I like to bang my drums for my area, you
sure.
know.
Of course.
And I always say, you know, like, if it wasn't for Youngstown, Hollywood, California would not exist, because the Warner family, the Warner brothers, mm-hmm. they were from Youngstown.
Right.
Oh.
Yeah.
So. We all got to come from somewhere. But right. Youngstown is probably one of the hardest hit areas in Ohio. And it's interesting that you bring up the Appalachian category.
Right.
That is something that they fight for because of federal funding.
Right.
And
that doesn't make it. It gives you a bad. It doesn't. I know what they're get more funding, but in the end, it gives you a negative connotation about the people in our area, about our education value or our work ethics, and
because of the stereotypes.
Yes, ma'am.
Although it seems to me that if funding can come in and enable people to sort of get a leg up and to make choices that enable their kids, you know, to thrive mm-hmm. instead of just survive, then in
right.
some cases, you know, that funding can really be instrumental in changing things, you know, in making a change.
Right.
And I think that's the goal. And, I mean, the goal of this, for instance, is for a congressperson in a district to look and see, oh, you know, in this district, you know, people are earning perhaps $8,000, typical workers earning about $8,000 less than the average for Ohio. You know, what actions can I take, for instance, to attract, you know, industry or to boost earnings? What policies do I want to support? What, you know, conversations do I want to have with the private sector, et cetera? So that's also, you know, useful for this, not to say, you know, we're down, but what can we do, you know, to bring ourselves up to the sort of the average for the state? Okay. What opportunities are there to seize?
Right. Okay,
yeah,
well, then, but I enjoy this conversation. You know, it's really interesting, this study. You know, it gives an insight of our country and where it's going.
Great.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Terry. We have a few more minutes left with Kristen Lewis and Sarah Bird Sharps. We're talking about the Measure of America 2010-2011, Mapping Risks and Resilience. It's part of the American Human Development Project. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we've got the related website posted on ours. It's wosu.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you if you want to check out your community like as did Terry. When you have a degree producers and degree magnets, you make a distinction. That's on page 118. I was looking at that last night, because when you talk about the number of degrees, say, in Washington, D.C., of course, that's more of a degree magnet, right, versus a degree producer.
Exactly. So people are attracted to the labor market of Washington, D.C., which rewards people with graduate degrees. You know, so as a result, the population there has the highest proportion of people with a graduate or professional degree and with at least a bachelor's degree of any place in the country. And that's true of all big cities, this idea that they are education magnets. But then there's, you know, a lot of times a tremendous dichotomy. So if you look at Washington, D.C., on the one hand, it's an education magnet. On the other hand, everyone knows that the school system there is really struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the places with the lowest rates of on-time high school graduation that there are, or similar situation in L.A., for instance. The rate of on-time high school graduation is really low. The percentage of the adult population with at least a high school degree is also, you know, very low. Yet at the same time, L.A. has some of the, you know, best educated people who've come there for the labor market. So a lot of times this issue really comes up.
Another hot button issue is obesity in the United States, and like low wages for women. There's no region that knows can claim any kind of success in battling obesity. It crosses over every socioeconomic and every geographic level.
Absolutely. And in fact, I was going to say that in Ohio, nearly 30% of adults today are obese. So it actually does fall in the top 10 in terms of adult obesity rates. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge concern, of course. And, you know, the obesity epidemic in this country is costing a tremendous amount of money, and it's really affecting the life chances of Americans, not just in terms of how long they'll live, but in terms of, you know, other, you know, issues of being able to really, you know, live to your fullest potential. And, you know, we talk a lot about obesity as being an area where, you know, one can say, okay, people just need to, you know, eat less and get more exercise. But a public health strategy based only on that we change our own behaviors is not a successful strategy. And we need as a nation to really look at what are the factors leading to this terrible obesity epidemic and what can we do as a nation, you know, to help people to make healthy choices and, you know, bike paths, ability to walk more easily, you know, the healthy choice being the only choice, you know, in school lunches, et cetera, a whole range of things that we absolutely must do, you know, as a means of prevention. And we've been very slow to, you know, to get on this bandwagon and to understand how critical it is we, you know, we take this seriously.
I would imagine that this is a sort of a project that if I were you, I would want to stick with this for a long time because you're going to want to see what happens.
That's definitely true. I mean, that's the beauty of the methodology is that it does track change over time. And you can really see what happens, and that's tremendous. So in the country as a whole, for instance, we can see that since 1960, Americans are living 9 years longer than they did in 1960. So that's tremendously good news. And it would be great to look at these data points in 20 years and see that people are living longer and having higher levels of education and that the median worker is actually, you know, earning more and has a higher standard of living.
What are the expectations for the project? How far out do you see this happen forever?
One thing I was going to say is
it's a long time, but
well, we have a finite life expectancy, so
yes.
But one thing that we've been doing out of this national work have been coming commissions from local organizations to look at a deeper level within one state. So we started out by doing Mississippi, and we were able to look at what's happening county by county and neighborhood by neighborhood. Then we did Louisiana, and right now we're working on a much bigger state, which is California. And it's really fascinating to go down to that lower level and to really look, you know, for instance, to divide L.A. into 50 groups and
right.
See, you know, what's happening.
That's all the time we have. I always ask the big question at the end. Sorry about that. Kristen Lewis and Sarah Bird Sharps, authors of The Measure of America 2010-2011, Mapping Risks and Resilience. Thanks for joining us today.
And thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ann.
That's all the time we have. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
The new film Blue Valentine is about a couple whose relationship has turned sour. On The Next Fresh Air, the film's star, Ryan Gosling, talks about unusual filming techniques, including moving in for a month with his co-star Michelle Williams and their on-screen child. Gosling is best known for his roles in Lars and the Real Girl, Half Nelson, and The Notebook. Join us.
Fresh Air is later today at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday Forum. Today at noon, it's Ted Strickland's final address as governor. Tickets and more information available at columbusmetroclub.org.
Support for WOSU comes from Thrifty Airport Valet Parking, a valet service for business and leisure travelers that takes you in your car to curbside check-in at Port Columbus, 614-237-5800 or thriftycolumbus.com.
It's 15 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:59 this morning. Sunny skies today, a high right around 22. Some snow moving in tonight. Expect less than an inch of accumulation, a low of 16 degrees overnight. A little bit more snow for Thursday morning, an accumulation of an inch, and then cloudy skies and a high of 28 degrees. Cloudy Thursday night and a low of 18. Good morning from WOSU 820. It's 11 o'clock.
What's going on down at Columbus City Hall? The casino is in the headlines again, fighting with the city over the sewer system now. Two council seats have opened up. Who wants the jobs? The mayor will seek an historic fourth term in office, swears he doesn't want to be governor someday, and there's more. In a city like Columbus, there's always more. Columbus Dispatch City Hall reporter Doug Caruso joins the program this morning to break down those issues and the more parts today. Coming up after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.